From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A good college education is more than just classes and memorization. Students fare better in an environment that helps them mature as adults, as people. Today, we'll hear from a university president who hopes her students will also remember to dream big. And we'll talk about what can happen when campus life becomes too much to bear.
What's the second leading cause of death for college students? Suicide is a prevalent on campus and across the country.
That's coming up. First, though, one of the voices we heard on yesterday's show belonged to Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez. She's an undocumented immigrant from Uruguay who grew up in Georgia. She is currently enrolled in college, but there was a time when her immigration status seemed an impossible obstacle to a higher education.
As an undocumented student, I can no longer apply to the top five public universities in the state or receive in-state tuition at any of the state's other public universities. I didn't know what to do. As my close friends were putting in their applications, I had to sit by and think of ways to actually get myself into college. And these were the same friends that I had grown up with. They cheated off of my test and shared my lunches.
Here are your first thoughts.
This is Mara Parker from Savannah, Georgia. I don't see how people can be so venomous about immigration and illegal immigrants when in our system in the United States that is broken. There are so many people that have tried to fill out the proper papers and go through the proper channel for immigration states, waiting 10 and 15 years. Fix the system. Fix the bureaucratic system.
Cairo Bibb tweets, if students physically reside in Georgia and grad from a Georgia high school, why wouldn't they get in-state tuition, discrimination slash control? And T-Barf tweets, I'm okay with the kids getting legal status and in-state tuition so long as the parents are deported back and go through legal process. We'd love to get your thoughts, so send them to us. You can call us at 404-500-9457. That's what Laura did. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Ted Cruz and John Kasich cleared a path for Donald Trump last week. They dropped out of the race, and that makes Trump the Republican Party's presumptive nominee. So we wondered about those conservatives who said, never Trump. Now that he's the nominee, have they changed their minds? Demetrius Miner is author of Preservation and Purpose, The Making of a Young Millennial, and A Manifesto for Faith, Family, and Politics. He joins us from our Augusta studio. Good morning, Demetrius.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Glad to be with you.
And Greg Williams is with us as well, host of the conservative talk show Greg's List. Good to see you, Greg.
You too. So let's say, Demetrius, how you doing, bud?
Greg, my friend. Glad to hear your voice.
I know.
Okay, so can we just start with the bare bones? Demetrius, you have said never Trump. Has that changed?
No, ma'am. It has not.
Let me get Greg. Greg?
Well, I've never used the hashtag never Trump. I think it's gotten a little bit self-righteous at this point. There had been some folks like Demetrius that had been never Trump before it was cool. So, I'm still grocery shopping, if you will.
Well, Demetrius, it sounds like you want to explain why you are still vehemently never Trump.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I am a committed conservative, and I believe in small and limited government. And the platform of Donald Trump is contrary to conservative beliefs. I'm of the opinion that it's best to oppose the enemy that I know than support the enemy that I do not know, that disguises himself as one person when in all actuality he is someone else. And I think Trump's rhetoric, I think that Trump's stance and what he has enabled throughout the process of the campaign is not only dangerous for a political party, but it's also dangerous for a nation in its totality. So that is why I remain never Trump.
Okay, so but here's the thing. You're both still conservatives and Republicans. I want to play you this comment from Atlanta attorney Jamie Carroll, who I guess he's going through a little bit of an identity crisis. He's been such a staunch Republican for so long.
I guess I just feel kind of like a stranger in a strange land when I look at the map and see how many Republicans are supporting Trump, because I've been a Republican and conservative for a long time. I talked to a lot of Republican conservatives, and I just didn't think that this would happen, that something like this would happen, that they'd support Trump. So I just feel like either I'm going crazy or all these people are going crazy.
Did you, Greg, think that Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee?
No, and I don't think Donald Trump thought he would be the Republican nominee. I, previously on this show, I've referred to Donald Trump as an undocumented Republican. And as soon as the the deck was cleared...
Is that the same as a rhino?
You know,
Republican in name only?
Not exactly, because Donald Trump, the rhino status is a little bit different. It's a colloquialism, and that's usually described as kind of a moderate Republican that sometimes negotiates with Democrats. That's more in the rhino genre. The undocumented Republican is basically me describing Donald Trump's history of donating to liberal causes, his flip-flops on issues. He's already flip-flopped in the past week about wanting to raise the minimum wage and some of the staunch conservative issues that his supporters had really, you know, binded with him on that he had never shown any predilection for prior to the past year. So that's my frustration with it, is that, you know, the barking dog has now caught the bus. What is he going to do with it?
Demetrius, I want to play you this comment from former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. He's talking about nationwide, nationally known Republicans like George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Mitt Romney, and Paul Ryan, who've refused to rally behind Trump.
When those three were the nominees, they expected all of us to support them. They would have been deeply offended if we had said something like Paul Ryan said yesterday. And I think it's a bit much for people who got to be president or got to be the nominee because of the Republican Party to now turn around and decide that they are smarter than millions and millions of Republican voters.
What do you make to this argument of party loyalty, Demetrius?
I dismiss that notion. I'm of the firm belief that you put principle over party. And to his point of the prior nominees in the past gaining the support of their competitors, sure, but it was not nearly as toxic as the political climate that we're facing today. I mean, Donald Trump just recently said that he doesn't need the party to unify. We've never seen, and I understand that primaries they're supposed to be intense. They're supposed to be politically combative to a certain extent because you're trying to gain the nomination for president of the United States. So you need to be pressed on your issues, on your background, what you believe for. But Donald Trump has insulted not only his competitors, but various demographics of people. And so we've never experienced such division before. And politics, in my opinion, is twofold. There's the policy perspective, but there's also the character perspective. And as someone who supported McCain and Romney, sure, policy-wise, they wasn't the greatest conservative to be presented forward for the Republican nomination. But I could also step back and say, you know, they still have character that's fit to be commander-in-chief. And Donald Trump, in my opinion, is lacking on both fronts.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Demetrius Miner, author of Preservation and Purpose, and Greg Williams is the host of the conservative talk show Greg's List. Greg, Demetrius brought up the insults to certain demographics. Yep. So I also want to play you this a comment again from Atlanta attorney Jamie Carroll, longtime Republican. He's actually decided to vote for Hillary, mm-hmm. though he says he agrees with almost nothing with her. So take a listen to what he says about the issue of demographics.
I guess I've always sort of like downplayed the racial argument that so many Democrats make, that a lot of the Republican Party is, you know, supported by racial tensions and racist feelings. And the fact that there's been so much support for Trump makes me kind of rethink that and maybe think that Democrats have been right about this from the beginning, because other than the racial issues, I don't really see how Trump can claim to be Republican at all.
What do you make of this? Is this a moment for the Republican Party to reexamine some of its underpinnings?
Yeah, and I also think it's a moment for the Libertarian Party to really, I guess, take advantage and leverage a situation where so many Republicans feel disenfranchised. I'll tell you, in the state of Georgia, Trump won with about 38% of the vote. That means 62% of the people in Georgia, the Republican Party, did not vote for him. Now, he is getting more of a plurality up in the northeastern states, and his momentum build, that shows you exactly why you need to be winning states, because when he swept the five states in the northeast, he was able to win Indiana, and that's what prompted Cruz and Kasich to drop out. I will tell you this, though, some interesting swing state polling came out yesterday that showed Trump and Clinton tied in Ohio, Pennsylvania, in Florida. So let's not underestimate the creativity, if you will, of the American voter. If you don't trust me on that, just think about Governor Schwarzenegger and Governor Jesse the Body Ventura. Again, I think that we're in for an exciting 6 months. It would not surprise me at all to see the Republicans really try to launch a viable third-party candidate, because there are a lot of folks that are not necessarily the hashtag.
You're hoping for a third party for this November?
I think that in this age of social media and the speed in which the ability to spread information or misinformation, I do think that it's possible for a viable third party to get on enough ballots, and it could actually stop either candidate, Hillary or Trump, from getting the necessary 270 electoral college votes, and that would make the decision in the hands of Paul Ryan.
Okay, so barring a third-party candidate, which it's possible, but that's a huge stretch. That would be quite an effort. Let me play you again one more comment from Atlanta Attorney Jamie Carroll, longtime Republican, why he's decided to vote for Hillary.
I agree with Hillary on almost nothing. I mean, maybe gay marriage, and that's pretty much it. On almost every other issue, I disagree with her. But I don't think that she will be irresponsible in office like Trump will be. I don't think that she's a risk to the nation the same way that Trump is.
So, Demetrius, where does this leave you? Who will you vote for when November comes?
I'm not sure. For the first time since being a voter, I'm unsure of who I'm going to vote for. But I do want to echo his sentiments. I mean, listen here. I disagree with Hillary Clinton on virtually everything. I am a conservative. Hillary Clinton is a progressive liberal. But what I respect about Hillary Clinton is that she's honest about it. She doesn't pretend to be a conservative. And Donald Trump, I think his character, I think he's irrational. I think he's politically unstable. And I fear a Trump presidency more than a Hillary presidency. Because with Hillary Clinton, I know what I'm getting. And I know how to position myself to oppose her policies. But I'm not going to pretend to support Donald Trump just because he has an R behind his name. That's ludicrous.
Let me just say one thing. I want to make sure everyone, our listeners, understand. We don't have a Trump supporter here because we have gone back to people who said never Trump to see if they've changed their mind. There are people in Georgia that support Trump. And over the course of our coverage, we have heard and we'll hear from many of them. But Greg, this conversation is about those who said we won't support Trump before.
Right.
And there are those like Rick Perry of Texas who said he would not support Trump and have changed their minds.
Yeah.
Do you feel like do you understand
of
that
course.
Also changing your mind?
Everybody likes a winner, and they're also looking at the danger. I disagree with Demetrius. I think Hillary Clinton, crooked Hillary, is a far worse option than a Donald Trump. Because if Donald Trump wins the presidency, then you can be assured that the Republicans will maintain control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Since we don't have a dictator, in theory we have three branches of government. I'm optimistic that if we did have a President Trump, that a conservative House and a moderate Republican Senate would temper down some of his rhetoric, and we wouldn't be worried about nuclear war or him pressing buttons. Congress is the one that declares wars anyway, so I don't have this abject fear that a lot of people do. However, I'm going to be entertaining looking at voting for the Libertarian ticket.
Gary Johnson.
There's two other candidates that are, in fact, Penn from Penn and Teller is moderating their debate coming up in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be a lot of fun. I do think that the Republican in me is going to take a really
hard look at
that. Yep.
That's Greg Williams, host of the talk show Greg's List. Demetrius Miner is author of the book Preservation and Purpose. Thanks so much to both of you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I hope to see
me.
You again, Demetrius.
This is On Second Thought. A recent story in the University of Georgia student newspaper raised concerns about how the school handles cries for help from students. The Red and Black says the university placed a student on interim suspension after she attempted suicide. Well, May is National Mental Health Awareness Month, and we've talked before on this show about the crisis in mental health for college students recently that's been growing for several years. We're joined now by attorney Scott Schneider, who heads the Higher Education Practice Group for Fisher and Phillips, and he joins me now. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. This policy, which is not confined to the University of Georgia, there are a number of universities that can and will take the step of suspending a student after a suicide attempt. Why? What is the thought process behind that as far as the university would be concerned?
Yeah, I don't know a lot of what happened at the University of Georgia, but I'll speak to the issue broadly. you know, I would say I would check your premise there. I'm not sure that I agree with you that at a lot of universities that the first step when a student commits or attempts to commit suicide is to involuntarily withdraw that student. In fact, for most universities, when they're dealing with an issue like this, a student who has attempted suicide, it's one of the biggest challenges that they're trying to manage. And there are all these constituents on campus that they're concerned about. Primarily, they're concerned about the student and can they provide an atmosphere on campus that allows that student to be successful, number one, and obviously not harm himself or herself. But we're also at universities around the country concerned with what is the impact of an attempted suicide on other students. You know, if someone tries to commit suicide in a residence hall, there are other students impacted by that. And what I would say is for most universities, these are incredibly complicated issues. And I think the best practice at schools around the country, you know, is you're working with the student who has gone through this. You're working with their parents, and you're trying to come up with a game plan that everybody is on the same page to do what's in the best interest of that student and the broader university community. You know, and a lot of times what I have seen personally is that, you know, mom and dad and the student and the university agree that after someone attempts to commit suicide, it would probably be best for that student voluntarily to go home and get the mental health resources that he or she needs.
We did reach out, excuse me, for just one moment,
sure.
Scott. We reached out to the University of Georgia. They issued a statement. You can find the entire statement on Facebook. But here's an excerpt. It says, quote, in cases when a student demonstrates behavior that poses an imminent threat of harm to self and or others, the Behavioral Assessment and Response Council, called BARC, in keeping with its mission, will assess the level of potential harm and determine the appropriate response based on balancing the individual needs of the student with the shared needs of the campus community. In cases when BARC determines a student is exhibiting behavior that directly threatens the student and or others, BARC may issue an interim suspension, removing the student from campus until BARC determines that the threatening behavior no longer exists, end quote. And it sounds like they're echoing what you were talking about there. Let me bring Victor Schwartz into the conversation. He's medical director for the Jed Foundation. That's an organization that's dedicated to preventing suicide among college and university students. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Celeste. Good morning.
It seems to me, you know, I thought about this quite a bit. And it seems to me that part of the reason for removing a kid from campus would be the thought process behind assuming that stress over being on your own for the first time, stress over classes and grades, that may actually be contributing to suicidal thoughts. Is that possible?
Well, that's certainly one of the considerations that schools make. So, you know, for a student who might have been struggling with depression or some other kind of mental health disorder for a period of time, in addition to the concern about suicide, in many cases they are lagging behind in their academic work. Their academic work may be a source of stress, but on the other side of that argument, in many cases, being in school, if someone has a good social support network, if someone is functioning adequately academically and socially, it can actually be helpful and protective to remain in school, even if somebody is struggling, as long as they're functionally doing well enough and there's a way of taking care of their mental health needs in such a way that you can have some sense that they're going to be safe.
This is all complicated, though, Scott, by what psychologists have described as an epidemic of mental health issues among college students. In fact, they did a study collected at almost 140 college and university campuses and found that students seeking help for mental health issues is outpacing the growth in enrollment by five times faster than the growth of enrollment. So how can universities even handle that kind of demand for mental health issues?
Yeah, I'd raise a couple of points. I don't know that the level or the percentage of students with mental health issues has increased over time. What has changed, I think, is the barriers to coming forward, the stigmas to coming forward. And so students now feel a lot more comfortable coming forward with these problems and seeking help. And I think it is a real challenge. You know, you certainly have schools that have multi-billion dollar endowments that can, you know, add staff and resources in their counseling centers. For most public institutions, which, you know, have been defunded by state governments to the point that their core academic mission is threatened in a lot of different programs, you know, adding staff to a counseling service to meet this demand is a real challenge. And so, you know, what I see a lot of universities doing in this regard is being very open with parents and students, managing expectations about what resources can be provided on campus and, you know, whether it's through insurance or whatever, creating relationships with outside providers to meet students' needs off campus.
Jed, how can a parent step in most effectively and efficiently? I mean, as a parent, I have a student getting ready, a child getting ready to go to college this fall. I mean, I wouldn't know which part is my responsibility in terms of letting him be independent and which part is the school's.
Well, so there are a couple of elements here, and I also want to just echo the comment that Scott made, that some of what we're hearing about is actually good news, that we are in fact, it seems, making some headway in getting students to come forward and reach out for help when they're getting into trouble. And that is probably behind some of the increase in visits to counseling services we're seeing. You know, parents can play important roles at several levels. First, if a young person through their high school years has had a history of mental health problems, it's really essential to work with the local clinicians, you know, therapists, any psychiatrist, psychologist, who are working with the young person to make sure that there's a transition of care plan that's well thought out. It's important to remember for parents that once a young person is accepted to a college, the parent, the family can reach out to the school, reach out to the counseling service, the dean of students' office, and make sure that they're part of that coordinated plan with local clinicians so that there's a clear understanding of how any necessary treatment will continue. It's also important for parents to keep in touch with their kids and figure out what the appropriate balance of that is. You know, you don't want to be checking in every 15 minutes unless there's really a crisis, because that conveys the sense that, you know, we don't trust that you're going to be able to manage and be okay. But there needs to be some understanding of how much connection, how much contact there is. And if a parent is concerned, it's also important to remember that confidentiality limits. If the young person is being seen at the counseling service may not be able to share information about the student, but they can always listen to a concerned parent. So if there is a concern, you know, contact the director of the counseling service or, again, the VP of Student Affairs or Dean of Students and let them know what you're concerned about.
Yeah.
They can take in that information, and as you hear, many schools have developed, you know, behavioral intervention teams or student of concern teams, and there are protocols in place in most places to follow up and monitor a concern around a student.
My guests are Victor Schwartz, the medical director for the Jed Foundation, and Scott Schneider, head of the Higher Education Practice Group for Fisher and Phillips. And Scott, at the point when a student has suicidal thoughts, which is different from a suicide attempt, there have been complaints, and we at this point we are not talking about the University of Georgia, we're talking about nationwide. There have been complaints from students that when they call their counseling, on-campus counseling, they have a 3 or 4 week wait time because demand is so high. What can be done about that? Is there anything other than more funding?
It's a great question, you know, and what I would say is, you know, there is obviously a difference between ideating about suicide, thinking about suicide, having thoughts, which is frankly, surprisingly, quite prevalent within that age bracket, and then an attempt, a credible attempt at suicide. You know, for students who are ideating, which, again, is a fairly healthy percentage of students, and let's say at a university with 20,000 students, you know, we're talking about, thousands potentially who may be ideating, you know, there's probably not a university in the country that when a student like that comes forward and says, I want attention and I, you know, need a visit right this second, that I can't think of a campus counseling center in the country that could accommodate that sort of volume. And so, again, you know, what I'm seeing is obviously at most universities, very active student affairs departments, you know, maybe not with psychology degrees or psychiatry degrees, reaching out to those students, offering resources, whether it's in mindfulness practices and things like that, or, you know, honestly creating memoranda of understanding with outside providers that we can refer those students to, that those outside providers may be able to provide resources a lot quicker than campus counseling services. But I think at most universities, I have yet to hear a campus counseling service, no matter how well funded, that said, oh yeah, we have enough staff. They could always add tons more.
Nobody has enough staff, Celeste, and I think it's a really important point. But most schools, and when we work with schools, one of the things we try to get them to think about is how to create a triage system so that the person who's picking up the phone or setting up appointments will ask someone, is this an emergency? Or are you having thoughts of harming yourself? And that would then trip a more urgent appointment. Many, many schools also have urgent walk-in hours scattered through the day or the week, depending on the size of the service. So, you know, schools are sensitive to the, you know, to the students who have a really kind of immediate need. But,
yes, and we'll,
you know,
we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. That's Victor Schwartz, medical director for the Jed Foundation. And Scott Schneider is with the Higher Education Practice Group, Fisher & Phillips. Obviously, a lot to talk about. If you or someone you know has thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Thanks so much, Scott and Victor. Most 20-somethings are too bogged down in student loan repayment or first job jitters to think about much else. But Paula Wallace was an exception. At age 29, she quit her job as a grade school teacher, and she started what would become one of Georgia's most respected universities. The Savannah College of Art and Design is better known as SCAD. 38 years later, the school has campuses and classes in Savannah, Atlanta, Hong Kong, and France. Paula Wallace is also the author of a new memoir. It's called The Bee and the Acorn. She shares an excerpt now.
In 10 years of teaching, I'd learned a lot about what was right and wrong in education. I'd done my student teaching in the Greenville Public Schools during forced integration and busing when, in a flash, half of my students were gone, replaced by new students. I'd been teaching for only a few weeks when it happened and didn't know enough to be anxious. When you're 21 years old, everything's an adventure. I moved back home to Atlanta and settled into my life in public education. I don't know how it happened, but I became a sort of itinerant teacher in the Atlanta public schools, getting placed in challenging classrooms that needed solutions. Every year, it seemed, I'd get a new call. "Will you go to Garden Hills?" someone from the central office would ask. Sometimes it was E. Rivers, Cascade, Warren T. Jackson, Sarah Smith, among other schools. "Sure," I'd say. "Why not?" This response became a sort of trademark, because why not? Every yes was a new door. I felt like Alice in Lewis Carroll's Adventure, whose stories I started reading to my students wherever I went. I wanted my students to see that sometimes you have to grow tall and big to get through a new door. And sometimes, well, you have to do the unexpected thing and grow small. What I learned from those early years of teaching was this: old institutions don't change much, or ever. Too many rules, too much to risk. If you want to do something new, you can't do it at an old place, at least not if anyone's looking. And in my classroom, nobody was looking. "Today we're going on a journey," I'd say, "but I won't say where." "Aw," they'd say in unison. All day I'd hold their attention with everything from popcorn to popsicles, and this promise of an adventure. And then when they least expected it, when all the other students in the school building were face down in textbooks, I'd line up my students and march them out to the playground. "It's not even recess," they would say, in awe of the wide world, like it was a new thing. And we'd go searching for colors, shapes, and ideas related to our lesson. I wanted every student to feel like Alice, every classroom to be its own wonderland. A decade later, I looked at my young students, and I wondered, what would they do when they got to college? Where would they go? Would there exist a university like this classroom, where the hands readily made whatever the head dreamed and the heart loved?
Paula Wallace is the president and founder of SCAD, the Savannah College of Art and Design. Her new memoir is called The Bee and the Acorn. This is On Second Thought. Savannah native Scott Aukerman is the creator and host of the TV series Comedy Bang Bang on IFC. The show is a podcast that started as a radio show. It blends conversation with music and comedy sketches and celebrity impersonations.
As my close friends know, I've been going through a lot in my personal life lately, but I'm not going to let that stop me from going out on the road and finding some good eats. Take a look. I'm headed across the country on a search for America's best burger. And my wife's murderer.
Comedy Bang Bang comes off the air onto the stage in Atlanta tonight, and Scott Aukerman joins us now to talk about it. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
I'm kind of sad in one way that it's a TV show instead of just audio, because I felt like I had this kinship with you. And I'll explain, because you know how people sometimes say, oh, you've got such a great voice for radio, and what they really might be saying is, thank goodness you're not on TV? Does that ever?
Yes, I hear that all the time, literally.
Is that how you interpret it, or just me?
That's how I interpret it, yes. Literally, because they follow it up by saying, because you're ugly.
No, they don't.
The strangest, most rude people come up to me.
So why did you end up changing the name from the original Comedy Death Ray radio title?
You know, the original title Comedy Death Ray had to do with the live stage show that I was producing at the UCB Theater in Los Angeles. And I originally thought the podcast was going to be closely tied to that, where I was just going to be interviewing comedians that I had on the stage show that week. And pretty early on in its inception, the podcast became this stranger beast than what I imagined it to be, where I very quickly found myself interviewing fake guests and comedians playing fake people, which kind of had nothing to do with the stage show I was doing. So we knew we had to title it something else to differentiate itself from it.
So I want to play a clip from the TV series. This is you and comedian Patton Oswalt nerding out over the seventh Star Wars movie.
I read for a part in episode 7.
No way, I read for a part in episode 7.
The script is really good.
It's good. It's legitimately really good.
I was amazed that the title, Star Wars Episode 7, Boss Nass is Back.
Watto's grandson?
Watto's grandson.
Such a cool character.
Great character. And I love how in the opening crawl they have the line, the taxation of trade routes to outlying star systems is once again in dispute.
Oh, man, I can't wait to see how that comes out.
So, is there a danger when you're doing deadpan comedy on air that people won't know when you're joking?
I think it's really interesting because the podcast version, I have heard pretty consistently that the first few times people have listened to it, they think it's a real show. They think that the people I'm talking to are actual celebrities, or I've gotten a lot of, boy, you have a lot of interesting guests on that show, because, you know, it's all comedians playing fake people who you find out eventually are insane. We're doing it pretty deadpan. We don't let people in on the fact that they are comedians playing fake people. So it kind of takes a while for people to warm up to the aesthetic and to figure out, oh, wow, this is all improvisational comedy.
How do you know who will be a good guest on the show? How do you know what are the traits that are needed to, because yours is a very kind of specific type of comedy.
It's interesting because I get a lot of people sent to me through publicists saying, hey, this person, could they be on your show? And I always try to make sure that the publicists convey that the celebrities are going to have to sit there while we goof around and while comedians are going to be improvising. Sometimes that doesn't always get passed on to the person, unfortunately. So they are in for a surprise when they sit down and they realize they have to share the interview with a comedian playing a lunatic, essentially. So, you know, but I think it's just trial and error. I mean, if people are ready to have fun, the good part about it is if you're on the show, it's not a traditional show, so you're not going to have to go to the well of pre-prepared answers that you have for every question in every interview that you get interviewed in. It's a very unique show that you'll never have another experience like it.
So one of the things that's come out of your show is the really popular web series Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. You've directed a number of those episodes. So let's hear an excerpt from one of them. This is the one that featured President Obama.
Is it going to be hard in 2 years when you're no longer president and people will stop letting you win at basketball?
How does it feel having a 3-inch vertical?
It's a 3-inch horizontal. So... Where are you planning on building a presidential library, in Hawaii or your home country of Kenya? Because, I mean, both places seem like they would be...
Zach, that's a ridiculous question.
Well, you know, I mean, not to bring up the birth certificate thing, but you really never did really produce your real...
Where's your birth certificate? Why don't you show it to us right now?
I don't want to show anybody my birth certificate because it's embarrassing.
What's embarrassing about it?
My weight on it, it says that I was born 7 pounds, 800 ounces.
I wonder how... Even in the original version, how do you pitch this segment? Will you do this segment where the interviewer is just going to insult you for 5 minutes? How do you pitch it?
You know, the first time that we did it with Michael Cera. And I knew I wanted to do something with Michael, and he wanted to do something with Zach, and I knew I wanted to do something with Zach. So we just sort of improvised it in a basement one day, and we just... kind of goofed around and tried a whole bunch of different things. And Zach hit upon this sort of mean interviewer style, which he's not really like at all. He's such a sweetheart.
Have I told you that I enjoyed the movie Superbad?
No.
Good.
But a lot of fun. It's a fun movie to watch, fun movie to go take a friend to.
What do you think about the inappropriate humor for, let's say, a 12-year-old, somebody your age, that maybe they aren't ready for that kind of vag talk?
I think it's, you know, any kind of, for a young person, any kind of...
Yeah, I think it's any young person.
That's how we pitched it the first time, and people just really liked it. I think celebrities enjoy doing an interview where it's not the type of interview that they normally do. You know, because at this point, we don't really have to pitch that show all that much. Celebrities are coming to us. The last one that we did, Brad Pitt, he really had been wanting to do one for several years and had been emailing Zach about it. And we asked him questions that I never thought that he would sit there and stand for, and he loved it. So I think celebrities genuinely enjoy doing it.
So as I understand it, you say that Well, let me put it this way. You used to host a public access TV show for your high school, right, called Centurion
Yes.
Highlights?
Yes.
So last year you did an interview where you said you're still doing that same show just with celebrities and not in your high school cafeteria.
Yeah, I mean, the show when I was in high school, I was very influenced by David Letterman. The early late night years back in the 80s. And I really wanted to do a show like that. And so that's sort of what the public access show was me attempting as a young high schooler to imitate David Letterman and to do comedy pieces. I recently showed some of those pieces at a show in Los Angeles where people were supposed to show their early embarrassing work. And the host said to me, "You were supposed to bring something embarrassing, not something you would still be doing now," which, you know, my comedy hasn't really changed all that much since those days.
So it's still totally deadpan.
Yeah, it's very deadpan. It's very ironic. You know, I think I'm from the generation of comedians who are influenced by David Letterman, who taught us how to do deadpan irony.
Well, I mean, you guys, you and I are almost the same age. We're 6 months apart. We both grew up in Orange County.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm from Mission Viejo.
Oh, my goodness.
Hometown.
I would never step foot in Mission Viejo.
Why?
A little too south for me.
Have you done too many awful things? They know your name in Mission Viejo?
Yeah, several warrants for my arrest out there.
But the reason I mention that is because I wanted to bring up the whole deadpan thing again. Because a couple years ago in 2014, you did a parody of the Red Hot Chili Peppers on your show. And you created a song, which I'm probably going to pronounce wrong, Abracadabra-lifornia?
I believe that's what it's called. The comedian John Daly created that, and he came on my show to debut it. It was a Red Hot Chili Peppers. It was supposedly a new Red Hot Chili Peppers song that they were going to debut at that year's Super Bowl that he had exclusive access to.
Burning down the 405, man, I barely feel alive. Taking the exit for the 10, she told me she was my friend.
A lot of people thought it really was the new Red Hot Chili Peppers song, which is really due to John's specificity with the parody.
We don't get tricked by the Alabama skimmer.
People really bought into it, and it appeared on that really official-looking website claiming that it was the new Chili Pepper song. And then the drummer, Chad Smith, actually tweeted it out. Leading more
people. He thought
people.
It was funny, yes.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous enough to be a Red Hot Chili Pepper song.
To you, is that success when people take things that you do seriously?
To me, that's one type of success. I think I'm not really a prankster in my comedy that much. I view success a little more as people enjoying what I'm doing. And you know, the kind of success I like is when someone comes up to me and says that the show gets them through their day or gets them through their commute. I hear that a lot. Or they're having a difficult time in their personal life and they put it on because they need to laugh. That's the kind of success that I like a little more.
So how does it change for you when you are the guest on somebody else's show? And I want to play a clip of a moment when you were a guest on Joan Rivers' web series that was called Bed with Joan, the late Joan Rivers. And here's a little bit of her questioning you.
What was your first show that you said to yourself, wow, I've made it?
Never.
Never. Because this is mine.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you so much.
No, I keep a bag packed at all times.
A go bag?
A go bag.
Like Mike in Breaking Bad, just on the way to the airport?
You don't know. When it's over, get out of town. Mm-hmm. Well, you've been fired a lot. I love you.
Thank you. I've been fired a lot.
I've been fired for everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like you almost couldn't restrain yourself from also still asking her questions, but what is the difference between you being a guest and you being the host?
It kind of depends on how serious the interview has to be. Generally, if I'm in a mood where I don't take any of the questions seriously, the interviewer will never get a single answer that makes sense. But normally, I think I'm a little more serious in my personal life than I am on stage or actually interviewing someone. I do basically comedy interviews a lot of the time. I do interviews where I don't really care about the answers, and I'm just kind of interviewing in order to lead to us doing a bit or for the listener to laugh at my question and to laugh at how stupid the question is and how, oh, wow, that person never gets asked that kind of question. So that's sort of my style when I'm interviewing. When I'm being interviewed, I'm generally just more of myself, which is a reflective, serious fellow.
All right. So then how do you translate all of these things? If it's been basically the same show since you were in high school and you've done all these different permutations, how does Comedy Bang Bang now transform into a stage show?
Well, we're taking it out on the road. And the thing that I get asked a lot when we're doing the podcast is there any way for me to come watch you? A lot of people want to come to the studio. They want to come watch it. We videotaped a few of them and put them online on YouTube for a while, and I am constantly asked, can you keep doing that, because I want to watch you do the show. People are really interested in the process and in watching us have fun doing it. So when we take it out on the road, I think that's what people are really interested in, is they want to see the connection between us actually doing it, and they want to see us coming up with everything live there on stage. And they want to feel involved somehow. I mean, the audience is very involved in shaping it. We listen to the laughs and what is kind of hitting with the audience, and we'll pursue those avenues right there in front of them. If something is really striking for them, that's what we'll sort of dig into and try to really mine. So, you know, I think people are really interested in seeing the process of how we improvise these shows on stage. And this is the third tour I've done, and it's always a real high wire for me, because it's odd to go out and tour and do a show where I don't know what's going to happen every night. But that's exactly what it's like. And I'm left up there on stage hoping it goes well and really searching for an avenue to pursue to make it go as well as it can for the people.
And but that would mean also that the stage show is demonstrably different than your podcast that you do without an audience.
It's a lot more relaxed on the podcast. We're just kind of doing it for ourselves, and we're doing it to make ourselves laugh. There is a certain amount of responsibility that I feel. People have traveled outside of their homes and, you know, paid $30 or $35 to come see us. And I really want to make sure they have a good experience. So we take it very seriously. But at the same time, you have to have fun with it. So it's a little bit different in the sense of, I guess the biggest difference is we're pausing for laughs.
Well, Scott Aukerman is the creator and host of Comedy Bang Bang. You can see it on Netflix and on the Independent Film Channel. But now he is touring the country in a stage version of the show. And his latest stop is at the Tabernacle in Atlanta. The show starts tonight at 8. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll devote the entire hour to a discussion about the movie Captain America: Civil War. A lot of that movie was filmed in Atlanta, you know. I wonder, what movie do you think has important, deeper meanings? Doesn't have to be a superhero movie. What movie actually really made you think? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on the Twitter, at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.